Emotional ability, anxiety, crying jags, welcome to perimenopause. 70% of women experience depressive symptoms and alterations in mood when estrogen levels plunge or start to fluctuate. While there are many factors that increase the risk, there is no denying that changes in hormone levels have something to do with anxiety, mood, and depression in people who've never had issues before perimenopause. So what's the connection between estrogen and emotions? Today's guest, Dr. Pauline Mackey, is going to break it down. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Pauline Mackey is a professor of psychiatry, psychology, and OBGYN at University of Illinois at Chicago. But there is so much more. Dr. Mackey leads a National Institute of Health-funded research program on women, cognition, mood, and dementia. She's past president of the Menopause Society, and she participated in Dr. Jill Biden's White House initiative on women's health research. She's a world-renowned expert when it comes to menopause, mood, cognition, and the impact of menopause on the brain. She's authored hundreds of scientific articles, and I am honored to chat with her on this topic today. So welcome, Dr. Mackey.
Thank you, Dr. Stryker. Great to be here.
You know, I also forgot to mention we're friends. Mm-hmm. And next week, we are taking a trip together. We're going to Sardinia for a menopause retreat.
Yes, looking forward to that.
So am I. And actually, at the time that this airs, we'll be back. And I'm hoping that we're going to do some taping while we are there, because we're going to be there with Dr. Dawn Musalem and Lisa Larkin. And there's just going to be panel after panel and discussion. So I'm bringing my microphone with me. So
wonderful.
Get ready for that. First and foremost, what was it like to meet Joe Biden?
You know, what was amazing with Dr. Biden's efforts on behalf of women's health research is that she did it in the first place. Of all of the topics to choose, as the First Lady of the United States, to choose enhancing, promoting awareness of, and funding women's health research was such an injection of positivity in a field that, you know, frankly needed it. We are recognizing more and more the importance of menopause, which is wonderful, but we have a lot to make up for. We have decades and decades of studies that failed to include women, and if they included women, only did what we call bikini science, you know, only focused on reproduction and women's reproductive capacity. So to work with her on this initiative was gratifying, not only professionally, but also on behalf of women everywhere, just to be a part of a movement that said that our bodies and our health matters. It was a huge honor.
The other thing that struck me, though, is she was just not doing this on paper. She was not just making noise about this. She was really involved. She was hands-on. Didn't she even come to your lab to take a tour?
She did. Yes, Dr. Biden came with actor Halle Berry to our lab to raise awareness about the research that we were doing, which focuses on brain health in women and some of the health disparities there in terms of women of color, probably related to disproportionate burden of hot flashes and other menopause symptoms. And it was an infusion into our program of research that I will be forever grateful for, in part because that's how we started our partnership with Halle Berry, raising awareness and just trying to get Congress to do something about menopause.
And I also have the impression, again, that she was not a passive observer. I bet she asked some really good questions because she probably did her homework before she made that visit, right?
She did, in fact, do her homework, and she was very well informed about this. I think in part because she had the advice of a wonderful advocate on the Hill, Dr. Carolyn Missouri, from Yale University, who really led this effort on behalf of the First Lady. So yes, it was evidence-based and informed. And she visited not only our lab, but other labs around the country that focus on other areas of women's health. And then she backed it up with funding. So she had this ARPA-H grant. We were fortunate to get one of those in a totally different area, which is the neurobiology of migraine, specifically menstrual-related migraine pain, using some excellent technology from Caltech, which allows us to measure hormones through sweat. Imagine what the future is going to look like. Dr. Stryker, we're going to have little band-aids that are going to tell us what our patient's estradiol levels are from one day to another. So It's a really exciting kind of cutting edge science with my colleague, Dr. Tori Eisenmohr-Mowell.
You know, I didn't even know, I should know, but I didn't know that you were doing this research with migraine, because I was actually just starting to write a podcast episode on the impact of perimenopause and menopause on women with a history of migraine. So we're going to have that discussion, not today, though, because we did promise that we were going to talk about mood.
We are talking about mood, yes.
So I have an idea. When we're in Sardinia, maybe we will have a little chat about migraine and hormones and menopause, because I would love to hear more about that research. But right now, we're going to do that. Okay. But right now, we are going to circle back and start talking about this midlife emotional roller coaster, which is complicated. So I do want to break it down. And what I want to start with is to talk about really just defining the difference between a mood alteration and depression, because it's not the same thing, right?
Right. It's not the same thing. So it's important to consider both depressive symptoms that are more severe than what they typically are for us, but don't reach the diagnostic criteria of major depressive disorder. That is, we feel symptoms of depression and they affect our well-being, but we don't meet the criteria for depression. Let's call that elevated depressive symptoms for today's conversation. Then There's the more clinically significant type of depression, where we talk about clinical depression or major depressive disorder. That is a clinical condition where the severity of the symptoms is such that it impairs our daily functioning, and it is a disorder. And the definitions for that are that you have one of two key symptoms. One is sadness, what we think of when we think about depression, this low mood, this depression, or, and this is important, something that we call anhedonia, the lack of interest, the lack of pleasure in things that typically make us interested, bring us pleasure. Oftentimes for women's mental health disorders, it's the second one. It's the anhedonia that reigns really strongly in the diagnosis of depressive disorders. So those are, we have to have one of those, and it has to be every day for about 2 weeks. And you have to have four other symptoms. Those symptoms can be sleeping too much, sleeping too little, fatigue, changes in appetite. It can be other factors like feeling worthless or guilty, difficulty concentrating, what we call psychomotor agitation or slowing. So changes in our motor movements, and suicidal thoughts can be part of this as well. And what's challenging, as you know from your years and years of practice, is that some of the symptoms of depression overlap with those of menopause, right? So we have changes in weight, sleep, fatigue, difficulty concentrating. So it can be hard to differentiate these. But the main difference between the clinical depression, the diagnosis of depression, and the types of depressive symptoms that don't meet that diagnostic criteria but are still affecting us, is the severity of them, the persistence of them, and how they affect our daily lives.
And then we can further break this down as we start to talk about women that are having problems with this, who are struggling with this, is there's really three groups that I want to touch on. The women who have a history of depression from the past, people who it's a new onset clinical depression, and then the biggest group, the one with new onset who don't have a full-blown depression, but just have these depressive symptoms. You know, we'll call them mood alterations, just to simplify. So if we break down that group of those three groups, let's talk for a minute about women with a history of depression. what is their risk of recurrence of that depression during perimenopause?
This is such an important question because the majority of women who enter the perimenopause with a history of major depressive disorder will have a recurrence during the perimenopause or in the early postmenopause. The study of women's health across the nation estimated that 58% of those women have a recurrence of their pre-existing condition during the perimenopause. So this is a really important piece of information, both for women who have that history, and of course, women are more likely, twice as likely to have a history of depression compared to men, and for clinicians who need to prioritize, for example, who they might want to screen for mood disorders. And it's really the perimenopause that is the key kind of window of vulnerability for that recurrence. And we can talk about the neurobiology
about that. But my question is, when you break down that 58% of women that have a recurrence of their depression, are these women who had depression in the past who are no longer being treated for that depression versus women with a history of depression that are stabilized on some kind of pharmacotherapy?
So these are data from the study of women's health across the nation. And those are women who may have been treated for their depression and still being treated for it or not. I don't believe they did an effect modification. In other words,
both are in that group.
It could be both.
Basically.
Yeah. Okay. And as you know, many women experience depression, say, in their 20s. And then they find that they can go off of any antidepressant that they had for several years and be okay. And, you know, thinking about this window of vulnerability for that group and how do we, if you will, inoculate those women against having another recurrence of their depression is an important conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that breakdown hasn't been done, but it would be kind of interesting to know if it's the women who are currently on treatment versus past treatment who are the most vulnerable. The second group are the people who have no history of depression, new onset during perimenopause.
Yes.
How common is that?
Yes, it's less common. It's considerably rarer, but it exists. So most of the cases of major depression during the perimenopause are from women who have a history of depression. Yeah. It's much, much less common for there to be a new onset of depression.
Is it like 20, 30%, something like that?
It's lower than that even. Yeah. And the analogy that I make here, which I think is important because it shows that this is a real phenomenon, even though it's not common, is the postpartum depression analogy, right? So we know that there's this entity called postpartum depression. We know that after pregnancy, women experience an abrupt withdrawal, a decrease in hormone levels, ovarian hormone levels, right? So that's universal, but only some of us are sensitive to it, right? About 15% of women, we think. I think that is a nice way of understanding what happens in menopause as well, although most of us, you know, won't experience depression during that time. There is a subset of us whose brains are dispositionally more sensitive to hormone changes. And we know mostly from the work of my good colleague, Dr. Torres and Laura Mowell, that there is a subgroup of women who are disproportionately sensitive to either estrogen withdrawal or surges.
Yeah. And then we get to the biggest group in perimenopause, the people that don't have a full out depression, but have depressive symptoms, you know, the mood stuff. And those numbers are huge. I mean, I thought like, what is it, 70% more?
It can be as high as 70%. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So you had mentioned that there are specific windows of vulnerability throughout the lifespan. And could you kind of run through what you mean by a window of vulnerability and when those windows occur so we can close those windows, avoid those windows?
Yes. So we know that there is a biological sex difference in the rates of depression. So females have higher rates of depression. And this difference emerges at puberty, which is interesting when we think about the neurobiology of it. And broadly speaking, the female brain doesn't like fluctuations in ovarian hormones. It likes that beautiful orchestra, that typical melody of our menstrual cycles, this predictable change in estradiol, in progesterone across the menstrual cycle. That's what the brain adapts to. That's how the circuitry is wired. When that orchestra is disrupted, when that melody is disrupted, the female brain has a difficult time adapting, at least for some of us. So it's the change in the hormones, the change in the predictability of the hormones that really seems to trigger depression and anxiety in some women.
There was a lecture that you gave not too long ago that I attended. And in that lecture, you talked about risk factors, because obviously this hormonal change, perimenopause and all that's a risk factor. But you said there were six very specific risk factors. So I'd like to go through those. You've touched on some of them a little bit, but I have a few more questions. So let's just go through those factors one by one. The first one was early menopause. And I read the statistic, correct me if I'm wrong, that in women who have an early menopause or a surgical menopause, that their risk of developing depressive symptoms or depression is like three times higher than the general population.
Yes.
Now, is that for surgical menopause or is that early menopause? Is there a breakdown?
It seems to apply to both categories.
Yeah.
It's just early, earlier than expected, if you will.
Yeah. One of the populations that very often has an early surgical menopause are women with a BRCA mutation, BRCA mutation, who have preventative removal of their ovaries in order to avoid ovarian cancer. What happens to that group? And we're talking about if they are not taking hormone therapy.
Yes. Here we have really important data from a study out of Australia called What Happens After Menopause. So this was one of the first and largest studies to follow BRCA women, so women who carry this risk gene for breast cancer and who therefore have their ovaries removed to lower their risk of breast cancer. They find that the incidence of depression following this early removal of the ovaries in this population was more than two times higher. So that was in comparison to a control group. And it was not only for incident depression, meaning new onset depression, but also chronic depression. So that there they showed three times the risk of chronic depression, meaning every time they measured depression symptoms, these women fell into that category.
And am I correct when I said that these are women who are not taking hormone therapy? Are the numbers different in women with hormone therapy?
So this is a critical question. That study looked to see whether or not the risk of depression varied depending on whether women were on hormone therapy. And in that study, it did not seem to matter.
Really?
Now, it did not matter, which was interesting. And that finding is not terribly different from what others have found. So for example, there's a large observational study, meaning a study, a population-based study of women who had their ovaries removed from the Mayo Clinic. They too found that early menopause was associated with an elevated risk of clinician-diagnosed depression. But in that study, use of estradiol of hormone therapy did not seem to matter either for the incidence of depression. So this is somewhat...
Depression or depressive symptoms? Because they're not the same thing, obviously.
Both of these were depression.
Okay,
these were both depression.
That is different.
We are going to get into
more of the weeds later about, you know, the impact of hormone therapy and treatment and all of that. But that is so interesting.
It's interesting. And some have questioned whether the doses of hormone therapy given to BRCA-positive women after surgery are sufficient. They might be too low because people might be, you know, cautious about giving hormone therapy to women who are BRCA-positive, even though, as you know, the data from Dr. Donchick and others suggests that your morbidity and mortality is improved with hormone therapy with little risk.
Discussion with Corinne Men, who is a huge advocate for hormone therapy in women who have removal of their ovaries. And she made the point of saying too often these women are given the typical menopausal hormone therapy, which is very, very low dose and doesn't go anywhere near physiologic levels. And you're looking at women that very often are in their 20s or 30s who really need much higher doses. So I Yes. think that's also Yes. a very important point. The second risk factor was the history of major depressive disorders, which we've already talked about. So we can pass on to number three that you talked about a little bit, but I want to talk about a little bit more, is this concept of hormone sensitivity, that there's a difference in individual sensitivities to fluctuations in estradiol. And so, you know, obviously, I mean, we're getting into a little bit about what's going on in the brain. Do we know what factors make women more sensitive to hormonal fluctuations, or is there any way to predict who's going to be more sensitive, or we just don't know that?
We're beginning to understand what makes some women more sensitive to hormonal fluctuations compared to other women. It's coming from the literature on women who develop suicidal thoughts and severe depressive symptoms when they're at the end of their menstrual cycle, when hormone levels are changing at that point. And it's actually work out of my colleague, Dr. Eisenlohr Mowell's lab, which suggests that there are alterations in the sensitivity of a receptor in the brain for one particular chemical called GABA. And mm-hmm. that depending on who we are, the makeup of that receptor differs, and how mm-hmm. my receptor is formed may very well predict how sensitive I am to changes in hormone levels. So mm-hmm. yes, we are beginning to understand that. And it's really important, I think, Dr. Stryker, that your audience understand that it really is the fluctuations in hormones, not the loss of hormones, that matters here, because it does have implications for how we treat it. We're not trying to, in the natural perimenopause, replace hormones per se. What we're trying to do is to take away the hormonal variability.
All right, so here's my question that I've never gotten a satisfactory answer for, and I know that you will have the answer. Yes, okay, we're talking about fluctuations. We're talking about a brain that's saying, what the hell's going on? One day I've got estrogen, the next day I don't, and I can't adapt to this. Then why is it that women who are the most at risk are the women who have ovary removal and don't have any fluctuations? They go from sky-high estrogen to zero estrogen. You would think after a very short period of time, the brain would say, okay, I get it. There's no estrogen around. Let's adapt. Why are those women the ones who suffer the most when, in fact, they're not having these up and down and crazy roller coaster fluctuations? They just go from up to zero.
Yes, I think we need to distinguish between the neurobiology of perimenopause-related depression in naturally menopausal women, where it is the hormonal variability that matters, from what's happening in the brains of women who go from being premenopausal to postmenopausal in a day. Those are different hormonal changes. In one case, in the natural menopause, you have these variations in estradiol across, you know, the menstrual cycle that are larger in the perimenopause than in the premenopause. And that's what's disrupting. And there we think it's a GABA receptor makeup kind of story. From the story of women who have their ovaries removed and are plunged into menopause at a rate that is, you know, disproportionate to what's happening in the natural menopause. Yeah. It may very well be that there's a story there with GABA receptor makeup as well, but it's probably also the fact that estrogen receptors are co-localized, meaning they're right next to serotonin receptors in the brain. And your audience probably has heard of SSRIs as a treatment for depression, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And the idea behind that class of medications is that we want to increase serotonin transmission. We want to increase the amount of this chemical that's flowing, if you will, through mood circuits in the brain. when our estrogen levels are plunged, when that estrogen is taken away, we know that there's a kind of remodeling of serotonin receptors in the brain. So that mechanism of action is probably more evident in the case where a woman experiences postmenopause in a day. There is a rapid, if you will, remodeling of affective circuits in the brain. And I wouldn't say necessarily that they're at, we know that it's a risk factor, but for women who have this estrogen sensitivity, that's also a serious risk factor for those women. You know, is what I'm saying. So it's a less common risk factor, but for those women, the risk of depression is very real.
You know, I started off saying about how complex this all is, and part of this complexity is it's not just about hormones. It's also about neurotransmitters. And it's also, of course, about these receptors. And we've been focusing on estrogen, but I think this would be a good time to mention progesterone, because the GABA receptors also are intimately involved with progesterone levels, correct?
Yes, they are. So we think about progesterone as, you know, the other, not estrogen, but the other hormone that changes. And it's important, right? Progesterone's important, we think, for things like how we sleep, water retention, lots of things. Progesterone and mood is a really important topic, because progesterone is broken down into what we call metabolites, one of which is allopregnanolone. And allopregnanolone, it turns out, is really important in women's mental health. We know it's really important in women's mental health because there is an evidence-based FDA-approved treatment for postpartum depression that's based on the idea that what happens in many women with postpartum depression is that the rapid decline in progesterone following childbirth leads to a rapid decline in this breakdown product of progesterone, allopregnanolone, and that if you replace that lost allopregnanolone, you get an improvement, a rapid improvement in mood. So the new treatments for postpartum depression are based on this idea of replacing allopregnanolone. And we have shown in some of our perinatal work that it's more complicated than that. So that depression we think early in pregnancy is actually due to the rise in allo, the change in allopregnanolone, not any loss of allopregnanolone. Again, with this idea that it's changes in hormones rather than their absolute levels that seem to matter.
Yeah. And a little bit later, when we talk a little bit more about treatment, we're going to get into the issue of if taking progesterone is ever appropriate or helpful. But we're going to table that for right now. So I want to get to the next risk factor for having these issues. And this is one that will not be a surprise at all to anyone who's experienced this. And that's persistent menopause symptoms. I mean, we know that women that have terrible hot flashes are much more likely to have depressive symptoms than women who don't, correct?
Yes. And this is very important, right? Because we have 75 to 80% of women will have hot flashes. And we know that there is this correlation between hot flash severity and frequency and mood problems, right? But what's leading what? Is it our mood that's leading us to have more hot flashes? Is the hot flash leading us to have mood problems, or are they all just due to estrogen and they co-occur but don't relate to one another? That's a really important question, because it tells us how to go about treating the mood problems if we do have them. And it turns out that studies have looked at women wearing devices to measure their hot flashes objectively, wearing devices, you know, over several days, and then surveying them periodically throughout the day to measure their mood. And they asked the question, do my hot flashes on Monday lead to my mood problems on Tuesday, or is it my hot flashes on, or is it my mood on Monday that leads to the hot flashes on Tuesday? What's the direction here? And it turns out, not surprisingly, that it's the hot flashes on Monday that lead to low mood on Tuesday, not
okay,
the opposite.
How much of that is sleep? Because you also
much
have to
of it is sleep.
Limit.
Much of
yeah,
it is sleep.
Between daytime hot flashes and nighttime hot flashes, right?
Yes. Yes. Much of it is related to sleep. So we know that 75% of the time that we have a hot flash at night, we wake up, right? So we know that hot flashes trigger awakenings. We know this from studies where we monitor sleep and hot flashes objectively. And it doesn't take a neuroscientist to tell us that when we are sleep deprived, our mood is lower. We're punchier.
Right.
We're punchier when we are sleep deprived. Part of, I think, of the irritability that many women can experience at this time is related to sleep deprivation. We know that whether you sleep deprive men or women and measure their irritability the next day, it's increased. And women experience chronic sleep problems during this time. So mood is not just depressive symptoms. Some of mood is irritability, and part of that is related to sleep.
And we do know, of course, that while hot flashes are one of the big factors that impacts sleep, that there are women who don't have hot flashes and still have sleep disturbance because of menopausal changes in the brain.
That's
so
right.
Has the study been done looking at women who do not have hot flashes but just have sleep disturbance and the impact of that on mood independent of the hot flashes? You know, so
yeah,
what I'm trying to get at
can they be dissociated? Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. And some people are surprised to learn about this. You know, we understand that the major type of sleep disruption in menopause is wake after sleep onset. That's a technical term. Basically, we're not sleeping when we want to be sleeping. We're waking up. 1/3 of the time that we're awake is related to hot flashes. The other 2/3 has nothing to do with hot flashes. We're just waking up.
Right.
So, and we know that women without hot flashes have that sleep disturbance. And yes, they have the mood problems. So you can dissociate the sleep-related influence of mood from the hot flash-related sleep disturbance and how that affects our mood. So you can just have the sleep symptoms and have the mood symptoms. You don't have to have the hot flashes. They can take place without that BMS.
And I just want to remind everybody that two weeks ago, I spent an hour talking with Dr. Jim Simon about sleep. And I think I forgot to mention during that podcast that there was one of the definitive articles about sleep and menopause was co-written by Dr. Simon and Dr. Mackey. So I just thought I'd throw that out there. But I really tried to focus with him on sleep and because I knew that I would be talking to you about mood.
It was great to work with Dr. Simon on that article.
Always. All right. We're on to the next one, which is not something I think people maybe are thinking about, and that is the impact of childhood experiences on perimenopausal mood issues. So tell us about that.
Yes. I think one of the most significant findings in recent years about what makes one woman's experience of menopause different from another woman's experience of menopause is that our childhood experiences, particularly adverse childhood experiences, not just abuse, but divorce, parental divorce, neglect, food insecurity, individuals who have those experiences early in their life show worse menopausal symptoms, regardless of whether they're psychological, if they're bodily symptoms like hot flashes, or whether they're related to genitourinary syndrome of menopause. It's thought that those early childhood events change the functioning of our stress response system, so that the stress response system adapts in a way to protect the body, if you will, from this chronic stress. our stress system is closely coupled with our ovarian function. Those two symptoms are linked together in a very well delineated fashion. And it seems that women who have these early adverse childhood experiences may have a different functioning of what we call the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis, how all of those systems work together. And this drives this worsening of menopause symptoms. We can see this association when we measure symptoms objectively. And I think it's really important to validate this finding that it's not just some subjective bias of reporting. We've seen increases in vasomotor symptoms in women with adverse childhood experiences. It's also abuse, and we have linked this in studies with my good friend and colleague, Rebecca Thurston, to worse heart health as well at midlife. And so when it comes to these early childhood experiences and their association with worse menopausal symptoms, including depressive symptoms, there all the hormone therapy in the world isn't going to help you, right? So it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of approach. Here we need to think about psychotherapies that can help women to manage stress and can help to manage stress responsivity.
Yeah. And specifically, there's been some work with cognitive behavioral therapy in
this
group, correct?
That's correct. Yes. Yes. And these are lifelong tools. I always say everybody should go through at least 12 weeks of cognitive behavioral therapy, because all of us have negative loops in our brain where something will trigger us and we will go down this well-worn mental path, some negative self-thought that does not help us in terms of our mental well-being, that increases our stress. And we need to unlearn that. We need to learn to take more positive routes in our thinking. Sometimes we'll have a good friend, family member who will point to us that our thinking just is a little too negative and not really logical, and we should be kinder to ourselves. But usually it takes a really trained therapist to do this. And I really, honestly, I say this oftentimes, the smartest people I know are those who did this cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a real skill. So it rewires the brain. We know from neuroimaging studies that if you measure brain functioning and our response to stressors and emotional stressors prior to and after cognitive behavioral therapy, it rewires the brain. The front part of our brain, our prefrontal cortex, learns to put the brakes on the emotional centers of our brain, our amygdala. And you can actually see that in neuroimaging studies, how you can train your brain to respond in a really healthier manner when we encounter stressors. And that's really good news for women. We think about medications rewiring the brain. Yeah.
Yeah, because people are sitting there thinking, okay, I can't change all this stuff that happened when I was a kid. And what do I do now? And as an aside, you know, I know so little about this stuff. And I was so excited last year when at the Menopause Society, they had a full day program on cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yes.
And then I found out I couldn't attend because I was in the room next door simultaneously teaching the menopause.
Yes, of course you were.
Menopause 101. And I'm like, drat, you know?
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the problems with these big conferences. There's always more than one good thing going on at once. And I just thought, oh boy, I really would love to be attending that seminar next door. And
yes.
I wasn't able to. I hope they do it again.
It was excellent. I was fortunate to be in that audience. And I think it's important to recognize that there's a role for cognitive behavioral therapy in sleep. It's the number one recommended approach to treating sleep.
Yeah. Well, it's that turning your brain off from ruminating about all that stuff. All right. So then there was one more risk factor, which this leads right into, of course. And it's not just childhood stressors. It's current life stressors. And we're not talking about what's going on in politics, although that's certainly part of it. But I mean, you know, I mean, what a bad time to go through perimenopause. You know, your kids move back home because they have no job. Your husband's having an affair. You're suddenly 10 pounds, you know, heavier than you used to be for no reason. You've just been passed over for a major promotion. You're having financial issues. I mean, we can go on and on and on about the life stressors that occur during midlife, but that also, has an impact on the chance of having these depressive symptoms, correct?
It does. And let's just for fun talk a little bit of science here, because I imagine your audience is saying, okay, that's very nice, Dr. Stryker, for enlightening us that if we're stressed, you know, our mood's going to be worse. But let's share a little bit of the science to inform your audience a little bit about how we study this scientifically. So remember, we talked about this hormonal variability. So if I measure hormone levels periodically throughout the menstrual cycle in women who are perimenopausal, I can show that the more variable those estrogen levels are, the worse a woman's mood, right? So this is what they do in those research studies. But then what they also do is they look to see whether or not there are certain factors that predict who will respond mood-wise more negatively to those estrogen fluctuations. And the number one thing was negative life events. So that the same estradiol variability experienced by a woman who reported a negative life event, that was disproportionately associated with worse mood and worse reactions to laboratory-induced stressors. So this is real science here. And it makes it, like you said, it's a double whammy. We have so many stressors at midlife, so many stressors. And when compounded with that hormonal variability, it's challenging. So in that case, of course, we want to take away the hormonal variability, but also manage the stress.
Yeah. And when I had a conversation with Dr. Dawn Musalem, I think it was a month or so ago, and we were talking about stress, and I thought it was so refreshing for her to say, you can't eliminate stress from your life. I mean, how often are people told that? Just eliminate stress. Like, oh yeah, sure. And she said, you're not going to eliminate it. It's really a matter of almost accepting what has happened. And then you manage it by using tools like cognitive behavioral therapy and all of that. And I think that that's a real shift for a lot of people to,
I agree,
instead of saying, oh, just, you know, eliminate stress. Yeah, right. Then you do yoga. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen.
I think too, it's a very Western idea that life's supposed to be stress-free. It's a very Western society idea that life is supposed to be stress-free. If you look, you know, in the East, there's this idea that life is difficult and you can't expect happiness, and that what matters is your response to all the negativity that life can bring, right? So I think that's a healthy mindset. And, you know, it all starts with women just allowing themselves to accept, this is good enough. I need to be kind to myself, and just stop this needing to be perfect at everything, to transition.
Well, and the fantasy that you can stress from your life. You can't eliminate it.
Yeah.
All right. Beyond that, beyond managing stress with CBT and acceptance and all of that, let's talk about treatments a little bit. And I want to make it clear, because I don't think I did at the beginning, you are a PhD.
I'm not a PhD. An MD. That's right.
Right. So you're a real doctor, as we say. And you are the one who does the science, who does the work that helps us do the clinical stuff. But having said that, when we talk about treatment, we are going to talk about the science behind these treatments and what we know in terms of how well they work. And I just want to make a nod before we get into really the dealing with what we've been primarily talking about is mood disorders and depressive symptoms during perimenopause, is that women who've had a history of depression and then get a recurrence of that depression, I think it's very important for those women to know that they need to get back into treatment. And very often it is a return to whatever was, if they're off treatment, is what was working for them in the past, in addition to treating menopause symptoms that they might have, like hot flashes and all of that. So I'd kind of like to put aside the major depression and really focus more on the women who are having depressive symptoms as opposed to a full depression. So the first group I want to talk about are the women who have no treatment. Is this ever going to go away?
So women who have no treatment for their mood?
They're moody, they're irritable. It's clearly something that came on during perimenopause. And they just want to know, is this going to go away? Or am I really destined to either live with this forever without, if I don't get treatment?
So here I'd like to consider the data from the Penn Ovarian Aging Study. And what the Penn Ovarian Aging Study did is it followed women over time, and they looked at the frequency of depressive symptoms, elevated depressive symptoms around the final menstrual period. So, okay, the final menstrual period being what we call time zero. In women with no prior depression, about 10 to 30%, they found that that's what they had. 10 to 30% of them had this elevated depressive symptoms compared to about 50 to 60% of the women who had the history of depression. So it's lower in women who had no prior depression. Their rates of depressive symptoms decreased the second year after menopause, where the incidence dropped to around 0 to 15%. So this is good news for women, suggesting that once those estradiol levels kind of plateau in 2 years after the final menstrual period, because I don't know that everybody realizes that there's still this decline epidemiologically in estradiol in the 2 years after the final menstrual period, that's when those women can experience some relief. I will note, however, that in the postmenopause years among women with prior depression, there were still 35% who showed this elevated risk of depression. So in that group, it was, of course, worse prior to and after the final menstrual period, but that risk did seem to persist more into the postmenopause among the women who had prior depression. But for other women, it does seem to taper off quite a bit after about 2 years after the final menstrual period. And it's worse than the years immediately prior.
2 years is still a long time to live with
these kinds of symptoms. It's still a long time. So absolutely.
I think you and I are probably on the same page that if this is a problem, if this is disrupting your life, don't just tough it out. You know, there is treatment. There is treatment that's going to help. And when we look in terms of treatment beyond cognitive behavioral therapy and talk therapy, which is very important, but when we look at pharmacotherapy, there's really two categories. There's the SSRIs that you mentioned before, and then there's menopausal hormone therapy. And they do different things. One, of course, is supplying estrogen, and the other is modulating those all-important neurotransmitters. Now, we know that roughly almost one out of three perimenopausal women are put on an SSRI, and the number of women that are put on hormone therapy is in the single digits. So we know what's happening out there in the world is that women are getting SSRIs. But from a researcher's point of view, what do you think should be the first thing that happens for women that are experiencing clearly what is perimenopausal depressive symptoms?
I think an SSRI is the first line of treatment only in women who have a prior history of depression and who experienced a remission from that depression with an SSRI. In other words, it's an antidepressant. And if you're a woman with a history of major depressive disorder and you responded to it, which wouldn't be surprising given that that's the indication for that particular type of treatment, then you should go on it again in the perimenopause. In other words, love the one you're with. If you're a woman with a history of depression who experiences a recurrence of it in the perimenopause, because it is a recurrence of a pre-existing disease, that's always responded to that medication. I distinguish that from what the research suggests is done in women who don't have a history of depression. And remember, here we discussed that study where my hot flashes on Monday predict my mood on Tuesday and the importance of sleep here. So what that means is that you need to really find a treatment that cuts off that hot flash to sleep to mood disruption pathway. And nothing does that better than menopausal hormone therapy.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that, which they always say a good interviewer knows the answer to the question before they ask it. I don't always know the answer with you, but I knew you were going to say that.
And although,
Okay.
It may very well be the case for the NK3 antagonists as well. So this new class of non-hormonal medications that also are very effective in treating hot flashes and also show a benefit to sleep, those may also confer benefits to mood. It hasn't been studied
talking about
as much.
Fezolinetant is one, correct. And elinzanetant is one that we expect to soon be FDA approved. And I will be talking about that in the future because absolutely, that's huge. That's huge. But I mean, let's think about this. You know, we have so many women who are being put on SSRIs, both to treat these mood symptoms, but also as first line for vasomotor symptoms for hot flashes, which of course is inappropriate. And in my Come Again series, I think it's airing right about now, is my episode on the impact of SSRIs on sexual function. So not only is it not going to work as well as hormone therapy, but then you're going to see the impact on libido and the ability to have an orgasm and on even weight gain. And I make the case in that episode that a lot of these women who are on SSRIs, quite frankly, shouldn't even be on the SSRI, which would solve all of those other problems. So I think it is such an important message for us to get out there that menopausal hormone therapy has been scientifically shown to not only mitigate these symptoms, but to have a big impact on mood, not just because it's getting rid of the symptoms, but because of the impact on the hormone receptors in the brain. And I think that that's an important point, because what about the woman, just to be clear, who's not having menopause symptoms? She's sleeping okay. She's not really having hot flashes, but she is just moody, snapping at everybody, sad without a real reason to be sad. Is that woman going to benefit from menopausal hormone therapy?
We think so, because we think that the underlying biology is that hormonal variability and unpredictability. And depending on where she is in the perimenopause or early postmenopause, the levels of estradiol and progesterone, or estrogen and progesterone in those therapies, is sufficient to take away that variability and therefore sufficient to improve mood. And, you know, there have been some randomized trials of estradiol in perimenopausal women who had minimal vasomotor symptoms showing benefits to mood. Yeah. So, you know, there is a there, particularly though, I would say in the perimenopause. What's interesting is that the data in the postmenopause is not as compelling. But in the perimenopause, it does seem to be evidence-based.
And when we talk about hormone therapy, that it would include the use of a low-dose hormonal contraception, combination of estrogen and progesterone, in women who are still menstruating and need to regulate their periods and irreproductible bleeding, and also might still need contraception. So there is still that benefit. So when we talk about hormone therapy, sometimes, yes, we're talking about low-dose menopausal hormone therapy, but sometimes we are talking about hormonal contraception, which functions as perimenopausal hormone therapy.
Yes. And can I just add to your statement about the overuse of SSRIs for menopause symptoms? I think it's also important to realize that impact on sexual well-being and health translates into relationship stress, which is one of the major predictors, right, of our mood, is this chronic stress. And so it's a very complex kind of causal pathway here. Between our sexual well-being and our mood as well. And social support is one of the key predictors of who is going to survive, if you will, without these mood problems. A lot of social support is really helpful in the menopause transition for mood.
One of the things that's striking to me is in my Come Again series, and when I talk about risk factors for sexual problems in menopause, and basically it's the exact same list of risk factors that you just gave for having mood problems is also the list of risk factors for having sexual problems, whether we go back to childhood trauma or current stressors or menopause symptoms. You know, it's the same list.
That's right.
It's the same list. So there is this enormous interplay. All right, progesterone. This is tricky because we know that during perimenopause, just like estrogen levels are fluctuating, women very often are also either having no progesterone hanging around because they're no longer ovulating, or there are intermittent surges of progesterone for when they occasionally decide to ovulate. But we also have women who have no progesterone at all because of a surgical menopause. And then when we talk about hormone therapy, and hormone therapy, of course, might mean estrogen. It might mean estrogen and progesterone or a progesterone alternative. It might mean testosterone. So, and we're not even going to get into testosterone with all of this today, because that's a whole nother topic that we could spend hours talking about. But I do want to focus on progesterone for a little bit, because very often women are told, well, you should take some progesterone to help with your moodiness. But then on the flip side, women are told progesterone might make you moody. So Dr. Mackey, let's just say we have a patient who is a woman who is going through all of this. She does not have a uterus, so she does not need progesterone to protect the lining of her uterus. She is taking just estrogen alone. Is there any case to be made for her taking progesterone or a progesterone alternative, synthetic progestogen, to help with mood?
No. So why do I say that definitively? When I was president of the Menopause Society, as one of my presidential endeavors, I convened the world's experts in depression and menopause together to come up with the first guidelines for the identification and treatment of perimenopausal depression. And we reviewed all of the randomized trial data for this purpose and came comprehensive reviews. And there's no case to be made for the use of progesterone in this context. It just is not grounded in science. And it's not really grounded in what we understand neurobiologically as well. Yeah. It's really the hormonal fluctuations that seem to matter here. And the allopregnanolone story might be used theoretically to support progesterone, but progesterone itself is not helpful, even in the postpartum, where we know that allopregnanolone is helpful. So it's not, that story doesn't line up with what we understand about the neurobiology. The only perhaps setting where this could be helpful is if you happen to be a woman who is experiencing sleep disruption, and for you, the use of progesterone at bedtime helps you to sleep better, so your mood might be better. There might be that pathway. But, you know, other than that, I think it's a real stretch to suggest.
Yeah, except according to Jim Simon, we don't have good science that shows that progesterone helps with sleep either. So
yeah, there's the one study of 300 milligrams given daily, where surprisingly it did not lead to any negative mood effects, but did benefit sleep. But yeah, I don't think a lot of women are using 300 milligrams.
No, most women are using 100, maybe.
Yes,
100.
Exactly.
But, you know, but this is out there, and I don't want to get into the land of TikTok right now, other than to say that there are a lot of people out there who are saying, take progesterone, including one person who is, and someone told me this, and I didn't believe it, and I went and I looked it up, and I'm not going to name any names here, but there's one person out there who says, not only should you take progesterone, but if you're perimenopausal and you're having mood issues and you're taking birth control pills, you should take progesterone on top of that to help calm things down. So it is out there. And I think the message is clear that the science does not support that. And that if there's not another need to take progesterone, there is certainly not a need to take progesterone just to help with these mood issues.
You know, in general, this I don't, TikTok social media approach of these excessive levels of hormones at face goes against what we understand neurobiologically, which is that the female brain likes predictability. It likes what it's always had. It likes homeostasis. It doesn't like to be shifted to a place that it hasn't experienced earlier in life. So, you know, there's so many reasons to be not only wary, but fearful of the kinds of hormonal regimens that are being offered to women. But it just flies in the face of what we've understood scientifically, right? So I've been in studying the effects of estrogen on the brain since the year 2000, when I published the first study of hormone therapy on the female brain. And it befuddles me how we're going back to these mantras that were in existence 20 years ago and resurrecting them despite decades of data to suggest that there's no evidence based.
Well, and part of the problem is this concept that if your body was making something and it's no longer making it, that if you take it, it's going to be the same as if your body making it. And that's not the case. And one very simple example that I always give is we know that collagen in your body helps your hair grow. But we also know that you can have an entire bottle of collagen and it's not going to make your hair grow.
Good so analogy.
And I extrapolate that to a lot of things with hormones too. Just because we make hormones doesn't mean that if you take those very same hormones, you're going to have the same impact. So with that, we have to stop. I mean, I could go on forever, but I know you have to get to work. And all I can say is to be continued, because I am going to bring a microphone with me to Sardinia, and we are going to be having some interesting conversations as a panel with questions from the women that are coming on this retreat. And we will have, I hope, more of these retreats in the future, because I think this is an incredible opportunity for women to be able to be one-on-one with experts like you. So thank you for spending this time with me. And do you have any last words before we sign off here?
I'll just tell your audience to keep listening to your podcast. I'm not just saying this because you and I are having a conversation, but in every public talk that I give, when I am asked, where should women go for evidence-based information? I say, I highly recommend this podcast in your Substack. So keep up the great work, and thank you for everything you're doing to help women get evidence-based information that will help them to improve their lives.
Well, let me just tap you on that and say, I couldn't do what I do without what you do, because you're the one that gives me the evidence-based information. So thank you. We always forget about the PhDs who are hard at work, who are actually producing the data that helps us help women with what to do when they're encountering these really, really very challenging situations. So thank you.
Great partnership. Thanks.